In September 2017, historian Greg Prince came to Salt Lake City to give the Sterling McMurrin Lecture at the Salt Lake City Public Library. Before he gave that presentation, I was able to sit down with him and talk a little bit about his forthcoming book on gay relationships. I think you'll be interested to hear what he had to say. He had some very candid remarks on this topic. Check out our conversation. But before you do that, I just want to point out that we've also got some books for sale on our transcripts here at Gospel Tangents. With November here, I know that I want you to think about giving some of these to your friends. I think you'll be very interested to learn more about the history, as these transcripts go into much more detail than any of our podcasts. So once again, please go to Amazon.com and buy one of our transcripts. This will help us to put together more documentaries, which is my main goal, as we put together more resources for Mormon history. Now back to our conversation. Well, welcome to Gospel Tangents. I'm excited to have Greg Prince here. Greg is one of the best historians that I know of in all of LDS scholarship. And so, Greg, can you tell us why you're here in Salt Lake City today?
I am here to deliver the Sterling McMurrin Lecture this evening at the Salt Lake Public Library. This is sponsored by the Tanner Center for the Humanities at the University of Utah. And the topic that I will be addressing is the biology of homosexuality and how that relates to LDS church policy.
Okay. So I was thinking this was more of a science than a thing, but so there is science involved.
There is science.
So I just actually interviewed Dr. Ugo Perrego. I don't know if you know him. So we talked a lot about DNA in the Book of Mormon and biblical literalism and that sort of thing. That's what I was thinking you were going to be talking about. So this will be interesting. I know just earlier this week you spoke with Doug Fabrizio on Radio West, and that was a fascinating interview. And so I don't know, would you like to talk a little bit about, just kind of give us a little preview, although this is going to be aired long after today, but tell us a little bit about, you know, where you, because I believe you're writing a new book, is that right?
Yes.
And tell us a little bit about that book.
The book looks at the relationship between the LDS Church and LGBT issues and people for the past half century. I started in the late 1960s because that's when it first became a recognizable issue within the church. The word homosexuality or any of its variants did not appear in the General Handbook of Instructions till 1968. And then it appeared once without any explanation.
Yeah, so and that just kind of boggles my mind. So why do you think that it didn't appear until the 60s?
Well, why didn't it appear in American society? That was 1968. The following year was the Stonewall Inn riot in New York City. That wasn't the initial foray of gay rights into the American consciousness, but it catapulted it forward. Mm-hmm. So really, the LDS Church was pretty much in sync with the rest of the country in not having pulled LGBT issues out of the closet yet.
Okay. So, I mean, I want to say Gary Bergera wrote a history on one of the church patriarchs, if I remember, that had an issue with homosexuality, which was before the 60s. Are you familiar with that?
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, it's still a matter of controversy, and I've spoken with his son, not Gary's son, but the patriarch's son, who takes issue with it and says, no, that wasn't the case. But nonetheless, it was in the 1940s, and the patriarch, whose name sounds like another church leader, Joseph Fielding Smith, was quietly released from his duties as presiding patriarch and spent the rest of his life living in Hawaii and teaching there.
Okay, so
but the issue was never a public issue. He was officially released, quote, for health reasons, end quote.
So we were talking a little bit about the church patriarch. Was his name Joseph Fielding Smith?
Yes.
It was. Oh, wow. Yes. But it's a different person.
A cousin.
A cousin. Okay. So so the official reason was for health reasons, but...
That remained the official reason.
Okay.
And to this day, family members say, no, it wasn't the case, and so I'll leave it at that.
Okay. So you're not going to second guess whether it was health reasons or not?
I have no information that would allow me to do that.
Okay. So as far as Gary's work, how do you...
Gary will have to stand behind his work.
Okay. All right. Well, cool. So it does seem that there may have been something going on even as early as the 40s, but there was no formal church discipline for gay members, or do you know how that works? Or?
There was nothing in the General Handbook of Instructions, which is the LDS equivalent of Catholic canon law. So if there had been any disciplinary actions taken in earlier years, it would have been on an ad hoc basis. And I have no information that would tell me if and when and how often that might have been done. But in terms of homosexuality being an issue that was finally openly presented within the church, it didn't happen until the late 1960s. Okay. Yes, there were occasional but very rare instances where a church leader might mention it in private or even in a public address, but it never climbed up the hierarchical ladder to make it into the handbook.
Okay. Okay, so you're saying that it was pretty ad hoc then, but it probably was pretty common if somebody was gay that they would probably were excommunicated?
What was more common in those years, if you were gay, you stayed in the closet. Whether it was as a Mormon or as a member of American society, not LDS. The downside for coming out was so extreme that very few people would have taken that initiative. Mm-hmm. And that's as true for Mormonism as it was for the rest of American society. In the 1950s, with the Red Scare, homosexuality and communism often got bundled by the people who were doing the baiting. And so that drove it even further underground. There were purges during the Eisenhower administration within the State Department and of other government agencies, not just of communists, but of gays.
Okay.
And so why would anybody voluntarily come out in an atmosphere like that?
Yeah, well, but there were some people that were exposed, maybe, because other people found out, or, I mean...
Sure.
Yeah.
And look at the consequences. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so can you give us kind of a brief history from within the church? I noticed on the Radio West interview, one of the things you said was there's been kind of some fits and starts, some progress, some regression. Church doesn't seem to be following kind of a steady path as far as treatment of gay members.
Until the presidency of Spencer Kimball, even though it was in the handbook, you didn't hear much about it. Now, that interim was only 5 years between 1968 and when President Kimball became president in 1973. But in that period and for more than a decade prior to that, Spencer Kimball had as part of his portfolio as a member of the Quorum of the Twelve, dealing with issues of homosexuality. So he was the one who had to review the details of the cases and make recommendations as to what type of punitive action might be taken or whether there might be restoration of blessings in the case of somebody who had been excommunicated. So it was a continual part of his administrative diet to deal with these issues, and I think it probably worked to polarize him. Plus, there was a statement that President McKay made to him where President McKay said homosexuality is a graver sin than heterosexual intercourse. Basically saying that being homosexual was a more grievous sin than committing fornication or adultery.
So even if you didn't act on it, that was still worse than actually.
When President Kimball became the church president, then that became really the standard, that if you were gay, celibate or otherwise, that was grounds for excommunication.
Even if you didn't act on it?
Yes.
Okay.
And it extended particularly broadly down at BYU, where BYU security would stake out gay bars in Salt Lake City, take down license plate numbers, and then the honor code office would bring these students in and say, either you tell us who the other gays are on campus, or we will expel you and have you excommunicated.
That doesn't seem very nice.
No, and this was all for being gay. It didn't matter if you were celibate.
Wow.
So that was certainly a low point. We eventually moved to a slightly better position of saying, no, it's not that you're gay, it's that you're acting on your sexuality, which is essentially where we are now. Some would say that's not much progress. At least it's a measurable change from where we used to be in the Kimball years. If you look at church policy, there have been some advances that are real advances. I think the most dramatic and maybe the most important is that a gay man or a lesbian woman can serve a full-time proselytizing mission with honor being openly gay, as long as he or she remains celibate.
Do you know when that change happened?
I don't recall that there was ever a written announcement of it. I've not seen a document. But it's been, I think, at least a decade since that change happened.
Okay. So that's one of the good things.
That's one of the good things. We have had a more compassionate general attitude towards LGBT people in the church, of trying to appeal to parents and other family members and fellow church members, not to be antagonistic, not to throw the kid out of the house, which too often happened in the past and still happens too much. But we've also had some regression. Certainly Prop 8 marked a political low point for the church, where their role in passing Prop 8 in California was so significant that in the minds of many people it became known as the Mormon Proposition. Then, in reaction to that, there was a gradual realization within the state of Utah that there needed to be some fence mending done. And in 1995, the legislature, with a big public push from the church, otherwise it couldn't have happened, passed Senate Bill 296, which forbade, by law, discrimination against LGBT people in the areas of employment and housing. That was a big step forward, because Utah still is the only state whose legislature and gubernatorial chair are occupied by Republicans that has passed that kind of legislation.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But then, later that year, the church came out with the policy. And so it was another low point. And we just seem to be in this cycle of step forward, a step back, and the LGBT population in particular, since they are the ones who are most affected by these things, is wondering, are we really moving forward, or are we just kind of being batted back and forth?
And what do you think the answer is to that?
I don't know yet.
So I know that November policy was hard for a lot of people. Why do you think that that policy came out in the first place?
Oh, I know why it came out, because I've talked to a couple of the brethren who very clearly said it was a response to the Supreme Court decision in June of that year. So in March of that year, you had SB 296. That was a high watermark. That was good news.
That was the stopping of discrimination, housing and employment discrimination.
Yes. Then 3 months later, you had Obergefell versus Hodges, the decision by the U.S. Supreme Court that legalized gay marriage throughout the country. So that was another high water mark for the LGBT community. But then in November that same year, he had the announcement out of nowhere of the policy. Now, what were the details beyond that? I don't have any firsthand knowledge of. But I do have good, reliable knowledge that the policy represented the church's response to the Supreme Court decision. Now, was it an essential response? Look at it and make up your own mind on it. You can come down on various parts of that decision.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about that. I actually spoke with Paul Reeve a few months ago. I believe it was back in February, or maybe it was January. And one of the questions that I asked him, you know, we have the second article of faith that says men will be punished for their own sins and not for Adam's transgressions. Now, a lot of Mormons, and I would say a majority of Mormons, would say that, you know, basically we're punished for our own sins, not for anybody else's. Some people say, well, no, that really applies to Adam. We're not punished for Adam's sins. But yes, you can be punished for someone else's sins. Let's ask you, where do you fit on that spectrum?
Within 2 weeks of the announcement of the policy, I was invited to lunch by the president of Wesley Theological Seminary in D.C. It's the largest Methodist seminary in the country. Subsequent to that, as in May of this year, I was elected to membership on the Board of Governors of Wesley Seminary. So I have a very close relationship with it. But the president, whom I've known for years, said, am I missing something here? He said, I thought I had a reasonable understanding of LDS theology. And his understanding included having been invited out here to meet with the First Presidency, take the tour of BYU. He's done some homework and he's fairly knowledgeable about Mormonism and quite sympathetic towards it. But he said, what is it in your theology that justifies beating up infants? And I said, David, there is nothing that justifies that. And I think it's the going after the kids, but particularly the infants, that has been so distasteful, both to church members and to the outsiders. But I think that the damage that was done by Prop 8 was mostly external. It was an explosion.
So when you're talking about beating up the infants, you're talking about the idea that we won't bless children of gay parents. Okay.
Yes, the ritual of blessing within the Mormon Church, as is christening within other Christian traditions, is the formal acknowledgement by the community of believers that your child exists, that your child has a name and is accepted by the community. We have denied that to same-sex couples. So in essence, we are saying your child doesn't exist.
Well, and it goes beyond just infants, but baptism and ordinations and things like that.
But from the non-member standpoint, at least with the president of the seminary and others I have spoken with, the thing that astounds them and troubles them the most is that we are punishing infants.
Oh, that's interesting.
Now, I said just a minute ago that Prop 8 was an explosion in that I think the primary downside of that was outside of the church. Yes, it did cause dissension. It caused a lot of hurt within the church. But for the most part, it was the world outside the church that just shook his head and said, look what the Mormons did. With the policy, it was an implosion, that the force was directed inward. And you had tens of thousands of church members who took the rather drastic step of resigning their membership. We have no idea how many additional tens of thousands just said quietly, that's enough, I'm out, and they walked away without bothering to go through the steps of formally resigning their membership. That didn't happen with Prop 8.
Yeah, I've talked to some of my friends that no longer attend, and some of them have taken their name off, some of them haven't. Why do you think, let me back up. Do you think these mass resignations and falling into activity have had an impact on church leaders? Have they noticed?
They have not acknowledged publicly that they have noticed. And in fact, we have had pronouncements from General Conference stocks saying, we're fine. There is no such thing as a faith crisis. And so on a public level, they have not said anything of which I am aware that says, hey, Houston, we got a problem. Now, what might be going on behind closed doors there, I don't know. But if the losses continue at the pace that they seem to be going since November of 2015, there's probably going to be a time pretty soon when somebody is saying, Houston, we do have a problem here.
Okay, so do you think this was a calculated decision that, yes, we might lose some members, but it'll level out and we'll be fine?
The way it was sprung on the church, and even sprung on the quorum, members of the Quorum of the Twelve said they first knew about this 2 days before it was leaked to the public. So I don't know how much calculation there was behind it. It certainly did not go through the normal process of being discussed, being vetted by the quorum and perhaps by other bodies or individuals. It just was dropped on them as a done deal without really any discussion. This is what's going to happen.
Okay. I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Greg Prince. In our next conversation, we'll talk about some of the common reasons that people justify the November exclusion policy. What does Greg think about some of these justifications?
It's not just a bad argument, it's a bankrupt argument. There's no basis in reality for making that argument.
Click here to subscribe, click here for a transcript, and over here you'll see some other videos that we've done here on YouTube. We hope you'll use this as a valuable resource to learn more about Mormon history.